Hi, everybody. I'm Sterling Holmes. I'm an alcoholic. Whew, boy, y'all look pretty good for a bunch of drugs. Thank you, JB. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Christy, Rick, Tom, George, Arnold, Winifred, all y'all, okay? Thank you all for having me out here. I really do appreciate it. My goodness. This is really, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, this is the first time you've been here. I know you're thinking that we're pretty strange. Well, you're right. We are pretty strange. But it's kind of interesting to think that people who are characterized by their selfishness and self-centeredness could be so warm and be so loving and be so open and be so kind. It really is amazing that we have the capacity for that. And it comes from a loving God, and it comes from the program, and it comes from a lot of different places. But when it's exhibited to the level that it's exhibited, you know, it's just fantastic, you know. And I've been the recipient of a lot of your love. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're entitled to just as much. So stick around here until you feel what I feel right now. Whether I describe it to you or not, you can be sure that I feel very good this Sunday morning. And I want to wish a happy Father's Day to all of you fathers. And a happy... And a happy Father's Day to all you mothers for, you know, allowing them to be fathers. So. I truly am grateful to be here. I mean, it was a heck of a ride. We had a good time coming in. I'm especially blessed to see Polly again. You know, I wasn't here Thursday. I missed Sharon and Bob, but I got a chance to hear Polly, and I've heard all the speakers, and Tom Wildham, oh gosh, and Joe did a great job. And, you know, up until this point, it has been a fantastic weekend. Absolutely fantastic. I should start by telling you how long I've been in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is through God's grace, program sponsorship, your fellowship, Big Book, a few other things. I haven't found necessary to take a drink since the 2nd of June, 1981. And for that, I'm truly, truly grateful. If you're new in AA, that date shouldn't impress you. It shouldn't. It impresses me, but it shouldn't impress you. You know, up until that point, I couldn't spend 10 days sober. Yeah, and it's because of your influence that I haven't had a drink since then. Because I thought about it. Thought about it a lot. I'm sure there's somebody thinking about it right now in here. You know, but it's okay. You can think about it. The guy told me when I first got in the program, he said, you can think about it, write poems about it, paint a mural about it. Just don't do it. And you know, I can attribute my sobriety to one basic thing. I haven't had a drink. That's basically where it started. And it would have ended right there had I not met you. You know, because I'd have been crazier than a bed bug. I'd have met a few of y'all this weekend. I know y'all ain't wrapped too tight. I know it. Because I done listened to some of you. And I'm in the right place. I'm in exactly the right place. This weekend has been talking about the realm of the spirit, and they always say it characterized Sunday morning as a spiritual speaker. I don't know why, and in about an hour, you're going to pretty much wonder why, too, but they always call it a spiritual meeting. Well, every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual meeting because it's filled with people, and if it's a good meeting, it's filled with hope, and it's filled with people in a struggle on a daily basis trying to stay away from the stuff that's just killing them one day at a time. And that's where our spirit has to be. That's where God's love has to be in order for it to work. So every meeting is a spiritual meeting. And every speaker shares their experience, strength, and hope, and there's something spiritual in that. Because, you know, like Joe said, I didn't think that when I was doing all that stuff, I was going to have to stand in front of a bunch of folks in Maryland and tell them about it. You know, I might have changed some of that stuff, you know. Made it a little more impressive or what, I don't know, but the fact of the matter is, when I was doing it, I was in it. Clancy talks about the Civil War, you know, he's a big history buff, and he was telling a relative of his about this battle, and y'all know you're pretty much right here in the middle of it, but he was talking about it, and the kid that he was telling about it says, you know more about it than the people who fought it, and there's a reality in that, because he had the benefit of perspective. The people that were in the trench were just in the trench. And I've been scared, and I know many of you have been scared. When you're in the trenches, you're not worrying about the aftermath or the implications or the aspects of. You're just in the trenches. You're just in the middle of the battle, and you're just trying to keep your head low and try not to get killed. You know, and most of us have a knee-jerk reaction to life, and that's what got us in here. That knee-jerk reaction that I had to life was I got either scared or pissed or I got away. You know, I had to get away because I felt, I've always been, like I was talking about earlier, I've been disenfranchised from life because I don't really fit where I'm supposed to be. I know some people that spoke this weekend do. They felt really comfortable. Like Jose lived in a cul-de-sac, you know? You know, that's cute. You know, I grew up in New York in the South Bronx. We didn't have a cul-de-sac, you know? I was thinking that when you were talking. I was like, oh, my goodness. You know, he had what I always thought. I was a kid. I grew up just a few years later. I was born a few years later than Joe. So I'm a product of that baby boom generation. I was born in the 50s. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I watched a lot of television. You know, and on TV, they always had that split-level A-framed house. Dad was an engineer. Mom was Donna Reed, you know. They always solved their problems in a half an hour. The kid mowed the lawn on Saturdays, okay? Now, I grew up in the project on the 18th floor. We did not have a lawn. My mother definitely did not look like Donna Reed. Dad was not an engineer. And when I was in the family, we did not solve any problems in a half an hour. You know, and I always thought that, as a kid, I always felt like if I had had that, I probably would feel better. If I had had that split-level A-frame, leave it to Beaver lifestyle, I'd be okay. I have been to thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have sat right next to people that have had that split-level A-frame life, and they're just as screwed up as I am, so that wouldn't be it. It's not the war-torn ravages of ghetto life that made me fearful. I was fearful when I got on the planet. I had something going on in my head that told me I was different from you. There were two groups in my life, me and all y'all. And that was the way I went to kindergarten. That was the way I dealt with my family. That was the way I lived life. I was uncomfortable. And, you know, Joe was talking about puberty was, you know, puberty is tough enough for the normal individual. But you add self-centeredness and alcoholism to it, and you really got a trip in front of you. And that was the deal for me. I felt, my full name is Sterling David Holmes III. Ain't that something? Now, when you got a Roman numeral at the end of your name, you're supposed to get a country to run. I thought I was the heir apparent to something. And at 7 years old, I got a little sister that moved into my room. Pissed me off. So you talk about resentment. I was resentful of my family because I always thought that they needed to fix me. If they knew what was wrong, then they could fix it. But I didn't want them to know what was wrong, because if they knew what was wrong, they'd know what was wrong. Now, if you understand that, you're in the right place. I was weird. And I didn't know I was weird. Because I didn't ask you. I didn't trust you. So I wouldn't ask you. I never checked things out. You know, I was just one of those kids who was strange. I grew up in Cali. They used to use the term, and I've been remembering this lately. They used to use the term when I first got sober, CIA. Catholic Irish Alcoholic. Now, I got two of those. I'll let y'all figure out which two it is. You know, I grew up in Catholic school, and there's nothing wrong with the Catholic doctrine. The people that taught it to me, some of them nuns weren't wrapped too tight that taught it to me. But I don't really have a fight against the Catholic doctrine or any of the ideas. I remember in the first and second grade raising my hand and asking Sister, how can you have a virgin birth? In the book, we like to be called precocious. You know, it's a nice way of saying asshole. Even then, I was being precocious. And she was not really prepared. This woman who was involved in service, because she had committed her life to service of her higher power, she was not really prepared to discuss a profound theological concept with an 8-year-old. So she did the only thing she could do in Harlem, New York, frustrated on a summer's day, hit me and sent me to the principal. And while I was sitting there waiting for the principal to come and hit me some more, I figured it out that you people didn't have the answers. Grown-ups don't always have the answers. Now, I haven't drank yet. I'm 5, 6 years old, and I figured out you don't have the answers. I'm already fearful, self-centered, crazy inside of my head. I'm an alcoholic, okay? All you got to do at this point is add alcohol, okay? But I'm suffering from alcoholism. I brought that to alcohol, see? So when I put it down, that's why my problem started. That's why my problems have always been more in sobriety than they have been in drunkenness, because I'm anesthetized when I'm drinking. But everything seems to come right here when I'm not. And I needed your help when I got here. I had problems going into this deal. If you're going to be a budding young alcoholic, you got to start buying your own stuff more than you buy other people's stuff. I listen to me all day long. Y'all don't want to hear what's running through my head. I tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now because that keeps it pretty specific. You know, but there's a lot of people up here talking. You know? That's not a good meeting. You know, and I had that going into alcoholism, and I still suffer from that today, and that's why I need the fellowship. That's why I need the program. That's why I need sponsorship, because I have that self-centered fear. I have that ego. I have all of those things that keep me apart from this planet and the fellowship of mankind. I mean, I separate myself almost as a reaction to anything, any stimulus. I thought that like one of those little paramecians, a little worm or something, you tap it, it just balls up. That's me. Immediately, that's my reaction. So by the time I got to alcohol, I had puberty going on. I'm really grateful that I discovered alcohol at 13, tall can of Coke 45 on a summer's day in the South Bronx. Because if it hadn't been all of the stuff that was going on inside of my head, I was too uncomfortable in living to stay on this planet. It was a result of getting the ease and comfort associated with that drink that made it okay for me to be here. And the funny thing about that is if it had continued to work, I'd still be working. Because when I took that tall can of Coke 45, a change took place inside of me. I felt like I could speak as well as Jesse Jackson, dance as well as Michael Jackson, play sports as well as Reggie Jackson. See? That's what it made me feel like. It changed my perception. It changed the surrounding environment. It made something different. And what it was it made me feel on the inside that I was different. And if it was still working that way, I'd still be working it. I'd have been on Baltimore Avenue being one of the Jacksons last night. You know, moonwalking down, you know, halfway here to church, whatever. You know, that's the deal. That's the deal for me. And the fact of the matter is, when it stopped working, I couldn't stop working it. I couldn't put it down because I didn't know anything about craving. Now, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. You would think that, you know, some of the things that I did, you know, my mother was a narcotics officer. Made me very popular in the neighborhood. Let's put it that way. Mom told me something when I was a budding young man, because we grew up in New York City. And Mom told me that I could do whatever I needed to do here in the house. Now, there are some people that would call that enabling or that she was being codependent. My mother was being concerned about her son. See, because my mom knew that I was growing up in a dangerous neighborhood. And she wanted me to be safe. So she allowed me to do whatever I needed to do in the house. She didn't know I was an alcoholic. See, because alcoholics in New York didn't look like 10, 11, 12, 13-year-olds. Alcoholics, as far as everybody was concerned, looked like those guys that sat in front of the building with a long overcoat and a puddle in front of them and a brown paper bag. That's what everybody thought an alcoholic was, if they even thought about alcoholics. That's the way they defined them. That was the way I perceived them. So it didn't make sense to anybody that I could be drinking alcoholically at 13 or 14 years old. Now, there were a lot of people in my family. See, my family is not dysfunctional. I know that I come from a dysfunctional family. The only thing that becomes dysfunctional in my family is me when I'm in it trying to manage everything. They get dysfunctional as hell when I'm trying to make them do what I want them to do because they're God's kids and he's got their program set up. And whether they're following it or not is between him and them, not me. You know, but the fact of the matter is my family was fine and all they did was they did things out of concern. And what I did was I took advantage because I have this problem called selfishness. It's all about me. So I drank at home, and I drank out in the street, and I did whatever I needed to do. And if I needed to take money from her to do it, if I needed to take money from my little sister who had her little meager piggy bank, I would do it because I had to have my pleasure. And I was entitled to it as far as I was concerned. And if it hadn't been for guilt, I would have never thought twice about that. And I probably wouldn't be here. Because it was the guilt and remorse that I started to amass whenever I violated the things that I knew were wrong. Whenever I violated those laws or those principles or those rules that I knew about, I'm not completely antisocial. Whenever I started violating those principles, I got a little thing inside of me called guilt. I got a little thing inside of me called a little remorse. And gradually that stuff builds. And you got to drink a lot to swallow remorse. You got to drink an awful lot. And I ran out. I stopped drinking and I had to do something with all that stuff. Thank God I met you. Because you helped me with it. If I hadn't met you, I'd had to blow my brains out. Because there were a lot of things I did over the years that I was out there before drinking, during drinking, and even after drinking. I feel bad about it. I really feel bad about it. Because I'm sensitive. I'm very sensitive about my needs. I'm not very sensitive about yours, but I'm very sensitive about mine, you know? And as I grew up through the time through high school, when I graduated from high school, it really didn't look like I was a budding young alcoholic to anybody else. But it was pretty obvious. I remember 16 years old, I tried to impress this young lady that I was going out with. Her ex-boyfriend was at the party, so I challenged him to a competition of drinking hot gin, you know? Cheap hot gin. We didn't have shot glasses because we were in the ghetto, so we used these little bathroom Dixie cups. You ever seen those? Hot cheap gin will melt a bathroom Dixie cup. So we were doing it like the Japanese, holding it in my hands and just knocking it back. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. I won, of course. He went for a walk. I passed out. And I was suffering from alcohol poisoning because my heart rate slowed and everybody was panicking. And they were really upset, and the prevailing wisdom was, let them sleep it off, rather than calling the emergency room or anything like that. And I woke up the next morning, most of us had slept over at this woman's house, and I was really embarrassed and humiliated by the whole deal, you know? And I blamed it on bad onion dip. Thomas was talking about olives, you know, with the martinis, must be the olives with the martinis. I blamed it on bad onion dip. It had to be the onion dip that gave me this adverse reaction. Could have been all that hot cheap gin I was drinking. Now, I don't know of anybody that stood in front of a county sheriff or a judge or a probation officer for an allergic reaction to tacos, okay? It isn't bad strawberries that get us in here, you know, it's ethyl alcohol. And that's exactly what I was intaking. And you could not tell me that it wasn't good for me. You couldn't tell me that. For years and years and years, I kept using it, even though the circumstances of my life started to deteriorate, I still liked using alcohol because it made me feel like I was a part of. I'm going to say that again. It made me feel like I was a part of. And when I didn't have it, I was a part from. And if you don't feel like you're a part of this group right now and you haven't had a drink, you still got a few things to do. But let me guarantee you right now, you are a part of. We love you. We have to. Our lives depend on it. So you're already in. Don't sweat it. You're already in. All you got to do is get comfortable. And we'll help. We really will. We really will. Grab somebody after this thing is over and go for a long walk and talk about it. Because it will work. That is a guarantee. It will work. It's going to take some time, but it will work. By the time I got out of high school, you know, if you're an alcoholic like I was, you suffer from blackouts on occasion and you like to be a part of things and you like to move and shake and you're very ego-driven and all that, you lie a lot. You lie an awful lot. And the best way I've always discovered to lie is to believe it yourself. If you believe it, you can convince anybody. That's why we can't differentiate between the real and the unreal when we get in here. I remember a speaker talking about it. He was telling his parents some tale of woe so he can get some money out of it. And he was telling it so well, it started to make him cry. You know? I can understand that because I create little scenes. I don't deal in reality. Reality is too painful. I can make my own TV shows up in here. My sponsor's always reminding me to quit writing scripts, because I write scripts for you and me, and I got the music and the lights and everything else going on up in here. It's a long day when I'm inside my own head, you know? And the fact of the matter is, when I lied a lot and you get caught a lot in lies, you gotta do one of two things. You either start telling the truth or move. So I decided to move. And, you know, I'd always wanted to join a gang. I grew up in the South Bronx, and there were a lot of gangs, and I liked the conviviality, the camaraderie in a gang. You know, I loved that sense of belonging. But none of the guys that were in gangs of them were my friends would allow me to because I went to some good schools. My mother and father took great pains to try to give me a good education in New York. So they thought I had some talent for the outside world. They wouldn't allow me to get into a gang because they were afraid that I would destroy myself. That's an interesting idea. That people who were about negative things would not allow people who might be about positive things from getting involved. They kept me outside of that. They wouldn't allow me to join a gang. But I decided to join a big gang, the Department of Defense. I mean, if you're going to get into a gang, get into a gang that's got nuclear weapons. I mean, you know. Because when we go to a gang fight, we go to a gang fight, Jack. So I joined the United States Air Force. And the day I enlisted, they did not wrestle me to the ground and pour Jack Daniels down my throat, okay? The fact of the matter is, what they thought they were getting was a reasonably sane, intelligent young man that they were going to train and send a few places. And what I thought I was going to get was what I needed was, you know, a way to get away and some money and a way to get away from parents, mommy and daddy. Now, neither one of us knew that I suffered from alcoholism. If we had, we probably would have tore that contract up. Because the funny thing about this disease, it will not allow you to be a good employee or a good soldier or statesman or dad or brother, husband, friend. It will not allow you to do that. It is a rapacious creditor. It will take it all. And it was taking stuff from me, and I did not know that. And neither did anybody that was around me. They had some concerns, but because I was talented and I moved quick, they could never really put their finger on it until it got worse. And if you're new in here and you don't want to go back out, understand this one thing. It will get worse. It will get worse. And it was on its way to getting worse, and I didn't know it. I joined the United States Air Force, and they sent me to California, and I just blossomed. Because they gave me that little Petri dish, I think, for the development of alcoholism. They gave me an environment where I could really blossom into a good drunk. They gave me an income, and they gave me a place to crash. I mean, you need an income if you're going to do alcoholism right. You need an income. Don't have to be your income, but you need an income. You need a place to crash. Don't have to be your place to crash, but you need a place to crash, and you have to have, at least initially, some food. Towards the end, that's not that important, you know? And the military provided me with that, so I blossomed in alcoholism, and they didn't know, and I didn't know, and I just kept doing it. Now, I secretly feared, as all of us, Joe was talking about, we recreate ourselves, we start to go, yeah, I'm going to go to the gym more, I'm going to read some books, I'm going to exercise, I'm going to get better. We always try to recover, you know? We're always trying to recover. And I thought that maybe I needed to be domesticated. So I, you know, I did a little target acquisition. Locked on. Pursued, okay? Now, I know something about relationships with I love this thing about alcoholics. Alcoholics don't date, okay? We hunt down and capture. Okay? That's what we do. We hunt down and capture. You know, beep, 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 you know, bang, you know? Locked down. Now, most people who have any kind of interaction with us sense a little bit of danger, and they run. Al-Anons don't run all that fast. They just kind of slowly trot, you know? So I found the object of my obsession, and I promised her everything. I mean, I just wooed her. And she had a little hesitation, to be honest. She had a little hesitation, but I just kept bombarding, you know, a steady barrage. Sooner or later, you're going to relent, you know, and that's what happened. And we got married, and she immediately went overseas. And as soon as I got over there after finagling a situation, you know, when we don't like things the way we are, what do? We change them, you know, to our satisfaction. And I manipulated the military and got over to that same base, and soon after we had a little girl. You know, so now here I am overseas. Before I went over to Japan, terrible thing happened. My mother got hit by a car, knocked about 50, 55 feet, put into a coma for 2.5 weeks. She struggled and she never regained consciousness. And on the 2nd of September, 1978, she passed away. We put her in the ground. I left Texas and went there to bury my mom. Now, a lot of things between me and my mother had never been resolved. And as far as I was concerned at that point, they wouldn't be. Because we put her in the ground and all the guilt associated. See, mom, every once in a while on the weekends, I'd come home from hanging out in the street, and my mother would be laying out in the living room, passed out, a little drunk, playing Marvin Gaye and, you know, the Shirelles and Gladys Knight and the Pips and Otis Redding and his little 40. Oh yeah, back in the old days, we had these little phonographs that played music. We put a needle on it, played music. That's for newcomers. It was sort of like a CD, but it was a different color. So I would turn this apparatus off and put mom to bed, and I would judge her and think to myself, you know, I will never be that bad. I will never be like that. And I never was. I passed out on the couch and I played Earth, Wind & Fire records, a completely different thing. But mom never said to anybody in my family, to my knowledge, that she was an alcoholic. She never worried about her drinking. She never mentioned it to anyone. She never went to an AA meeting. And if I can't call you one until you call you one, I certainly couldn't call mom one. When I was in trouble, I used to call mom one. When I was in trouble, I used to blame the neighborhood or blame my parents or blame the situation because they got divorced and all that on my circumstances. And just like Tom said, the family was the family, but I did all that. There was nobody forcing me to drink. I was doing the drinking. And when I put my mother in the ground, that started the last two and a half years of really bad drinking for me. Now I was a family man. I had a young daughter. I had a beautiful wife. I had an up-and-coming young career in the military. I was a young military serviceman and doing some good things. God put me on this planet with some talents. And when I exploited those talents successfully, I did very well, as most of us do. We're great people to have around in a crisis because we live with crisis day in and day out. Talk about crisis management, you know. If we could let that stuff go, boy, we'd be some happy folks because we're always trying to handle some sort of calamity, you know, on our own without anybody's help. Great workers. Terrible people, but great workers. You know, and the fact of the matter is the military loved me except when I would pull some of these boners. And I pulled a few. I mean, in Japan, they drive on the wrong side of the road. I'd get so drunk I couldn't remember what side of the road I was supposed to be on. Now, that's not good. The thing is that the military, like society, reacted to some of the bizarre behavior that I thought was normal. And society is very afraid of people that act in a bizarre manner. And they know exactly what to do with them. Put us in them rooms with the doorknobs on the outside. Or give us those kinds of clothing that have long sleeves. You know, one size fits all kind of thing. You know, or put us somewhere where we cannot harm society. There's an old timer in California used to say, my alcoholism affects at least seven other folks. At least seven other individuals are affected by my alcoholism. And that's at least as many as should be affected by my sobriety and by this program. At least seven other folks. You know, whether they be in the family, on the highway, in the office, or department store, whatever. At least seven other people should be affected by what I call recovery in my program of Alcoholics Anonymous today. That's my responsibility, and that's what I have to live by, and that's what I'm put on this planet for. At least that's my opinion today. But by the time the Air Force got involved in my life, you know, because I had sponsorship. I've had sponsorship all my life. My mother and father, my family was the first fellowship I was a member of. And the fact of the matter is, Mom and Dad sponsored me until I left them and joined the service. And I had a sponsor when I was in training, and I had a sponsor when I was drinking. I mean, I had sponsors at that bar. You know the guys I'm talking about. The ones that knew everything about everything, and then some of y'all that dealt with the left-handed cigarettes and some of the recreational chemicals, you had to have sponsors for that. Because nobody's born knowing how to roll a joint. You know, you got to get taught by somebody. The fact of the matter is, I was taught everything I needed to know. Everything I wanted to know, I found somebody to teach me. And the Air Force decided that they needed to do something with me. And they decided that the thing to do would be to give me a local program, sort of a group kind of thing. And you know how we do groups. We just love groups. Sit around and group one another. You know? You okay? Yeah, I'm okay. You okay? Yeah, I'm okay. You know, I mean, you know, it was group. You ain't okay. So what? Kiss my ass. You know? That's group. So Monday through Friday, I went to group. And I was, you know, a drunk that ain't drinking. Isn't he just a lovely person to be around? Spreading warmth and sunshine everywhere he goes. Family was thrilled, you know? Monday through Friday, I was just happy. And Friday would come along, and I'd go into that club, and I'd decide to buy a round of drinks and have a Coke with my friends, whose names I could not remember. And, you know, I'd have another Coke and tell a few more lies, and pretty soon I'd have a rum and Coke. And I'd lose my car. I remember reporting my car stolen, and it was the only one in the parking lot at the time. Needless to say, the Air Force was a little more concerned. They decided to intensify my treatment, and they sent me to a place called the Philippines for treatment, a month-long treatment. Now, I don't know about people that may have been in the military or people that travel around the world. Philippines is not the kind of place you want to set a drunk, because beer was a nickel. You could go outside the gate and explore every fantasy possible with $5 and come home with change. Okay? So the thing was, I did not think this was going to bode well. I didn't think that anybody had ever seen an alcoholic until I got there. And I didn't know I was exhibiting the behavior of an alcoholic. But when I got to treatment, I discovered everything I needed to know about the disease of alcoholism. You know, it's a terrible disease. I learned all about this illness. You know, I saw the jelly net chart, saw the movie, saw all the stuff about this illness. I felt so bad for you people. I really did. It's a tragic thing. I was going to give y'all some money, you know? Who do I make the check out to? You know, I mean, really. But I didn't take none of it personal. It wasn't me. They had a vote. There were 12 of us, 12 angry men, I call us. It was a vote. Who was most likely to drink 6 months after getting out of there? And if I had voted, it would have been a unanimous decision. There was no way in hell these people knew that I was going to stay sober 6 months. If it had not been for a group of folks that I met at Misawa Air Base, Japan, a little room, 10, 11 people, I walked in the door, and you know how I was greeted. You know, I hope you were greeted in a similar fashion. People smiling from ear to ear. Just, hi. You know, just, hi, how you doing? Hey, have a seat. Hey, have a seat. You want a cup of coffee? My name is so-and-so, and this is so-and-so, and this is so-and-so, and this is so-and-so. Hi, how you doing, everybody? You know, just smiling, you know? Just happy to see me. Warm, loving, inviting. Pissed me off. See, nothing was funny in my life. She wants to leave me. The Air Force has got my job. I'm, you know, in the balance. I'm in trouble. I did not see the light. I was feeling the heat. That's how I got here. I was in trouble. And the fact of the matter is, I was not a happy person, and I really didn't like being around people who knew the talent and developed the talent of unconditional love. See, self-centered, selfish, fearful people have a real difficult time sitting in a room full of people who are going to love them unconditionally. That's why we run so many newcomers out of here. Because this is a very powerful thing we have called unconditional love. It's a very powerful and wonderful and special thing we call acceptance and fellowship. It's very formidable. And most of us are out there in the streets all by ourselves, terrorizing and being terrorized. And when you come into a quiet, safe place, sometimes it can be more frightening than the stuff that you're familiar with. So when a newcomer runs out the door, maybe we should pay attention. Maybe we should get his number instead of giving him ours. Because they may not be back. This room should be 3 times this size, filled with folks. I know that probably we're here last year. The fact of the matter is, I met that when I came as a newcomer to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was greeted warmly. I saw the trappings on the wall. You had this, these 12 and 12 up. You had these two old white guys up on the wall. Had a picture of these two old white guys talking to another guy on a bed. Had these little signs, think, 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 easy does it, first things first, this too shall pass. All these, you know, I don't know. I just sat there and listened to you all, and you started talking about stuff, you know, I mean, terrible, tragic, ugly, horrendous, and laughed. Thought it was so funny. Yeah, I've been to 8 treatment centers, and they shocked me 16 times. You know? Yeah, I woke up naked on my front lawn. Ha, 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 ha. I'm sitting there embarrassed for you. I'm wondering how you can talk about stuff like this in public and still go out to work, you know? I mean, I'm wondering if my wife hadn't called y'all and told y'all about some of the things I had done. And you were making up stories and calling them your own just to hook me in. See, because you started with a prayer, you ended with a prayer, and you passed the basket. I know, I was a Catholic. I remember. Plus, I had quit Catholicism, was Baptist for a little. As a matter of fact, at one time, I was a Muslim for a little bit. I was always looking for that religion that would allow me to be a complete asshole and still get into heaven. And in pursuing, actually, it was this young lady that I was in lust with. I heard that that was what it was called. I thought it was love up until this point, but it was some people were talking about it this weekend. I wanted what she had, and I was willing to go to any length to get it. So she was a member of a Baptist choir. So I joined the Baptist choir to get next to her. So, and they got loaned out to a Methodist church. And on many Sundays, before I joined the service, I was a failed Catholic who was a practicing Muslim singing in a Baptist choir in a Methodist church. I was the type of person that pursued the Bible and the Book of Mormon and the Quran. I used to have arguments with Jehovah's Witnesses and win, okay? That was my religious background when I encountered you in Alcoholics Anonymous. So when you started with that prayer, you ended with that prayer, and you passed that basket, I knew immediately that this was a cult. This was a scam. This was a game, you know, because I knew it. I knew it. And I was waiting for you to put the lien on me. I knew that this was going to be one of those things y'all going to make me shave my head and sell books at the airport, you know. That's what it was about. But you never did that. See, the funny thing about having a spiritual place is you never have to convince people of how good it is. All you do is show them. All you do is show them. You show them in your kindness. You show them in your smile. You show them in your consistency. You show them in your willingness to be of some service. In every one of those religions I participated in, I encountered spiritual people. People who had turned their will and their lives over to the care of whoever, and they acted in accordance with that decision. And they were the ones that frightened me and made me uncomfortable. Because I liked hanging with the people who were half measuring. Because I've always been a 50-yard, 100-yard dasher. I've always been one of those people that'll pull up lame when the rubber meets the road. And I liked it that way until I met you. Because your consistency made an impression on me. I love that room. I love hanging out with them folks. And you know what I'm going to tell you, newcomer? An AA meeting is cunning, baffling, and powerful. They will make you do stuff that you will not want to do. They asked me to make coffee. I am a terrible coffee maker. To this day, I'm a bad coffee maker. And they asked me for 2 weeks. And you know I got there, what, an hour early for a 20-minute commitment? Because they gave me the key. I got the key. Come on. I got the key. I got to make this coffee. You know, so I did a big tureen. I put, there was 15, 20 people would come to the meeting. I put 15, 20 of the little yellow caps in that coffee. 2 weeks. 2 weeks we drank that coffee. People's eyes are closed when they're drinking the coffee. Using extra sugar in the coffee. They didn't say a word to me. 2 weeks after we got in the circle, and they said, we need another coffee maker. 2-3 people volunteered. Thank you for your service work, Sterling. Keep coming back. They asked me to chair that meeting, to be the chairman of that meeting, and I thought it was because I was so eloquent, so, you know, because I speak so well. And they knew I was the sickest guy in there. And the only way that they were going to keep me in the room was to put me in the front with the gavel, because I couldn't leave. So I would start the meeting and talk about whatever was on my sick little mind, and they would spend the rest of the time 12-stepping me. See? They would share their experience, strength, and hope with me. I don't stand in front of you because I got an ego thing about this. I stand in front of you because I know I need to be seen, and I need help. And the only way I'm going to get help is to make a little noise and to be seen. Because I really need you a hell of a lot more than you need me. And I discovered that by them people fooling me. They tricked me into reading the big book. They did all kinds of things to me that first year. Because I was arrogant, I was intelligent, I didn't want to just surrender. So I came back to the United States on fire about this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to call it a clandestine kind of deal. You know, and the only thing that was a problem, I thought, was it had a slight problem, and that was there just wasn't enough African Americans in AA, as far as I was concerned. So I decided I was going to dedicate my life to getting thousands of black folks in AA. I'd rewrite the book later, you know. If it hadn't been for my discovering that there were thousands of black folks in Alcoholics Anonymous in Washington, D.C. area, because I was here on leave, you know, that kind of pissed me off, because most of them have been sober longer than me, you know. But I was going to make a new AA. I mean, there was going to be another picture up on that wall. AA the next generation, you know, right in the middle, you know. They sent me to Florida where I discovered a group that was called the Dedication Group, and their whole thing was to support this treatment center that was up there, and they did a lot of stuff to help out this treatment center, and I learned about service there. They elected me as an alternate GSR. I know how to spell GSR because that's how you spell it, GSR. I ain't know much else, you know. And whenever we had traditions meetings, there'd be one guy that had 7 years and another guy that had 5 years, and they would argue about the traditions back and forth, and we'd all just sit there and just go from side to side like it was a tennis match, you know. You know, that was the deal, because I didn't know anything about them either. But I did know that I needed to do some steps, and I did one. I did a fifth with a Catholic priest. I must have done it right, because I'm still here. I think it takes however long it takes you to do a fourth step and a night, because that's what it does for me. And whatever, however long it takes and a night, because I can fill all that stuff in one night. It doesn't take me very long to write down what's scaring the living daylights out of me, or what I don't like, or what I hate. It doesn't take me very long at all, because I've been running that film in my head for weeks or months or years. So it doesn't take me very long at all, usually a night. And I spilled that stuff with that priest, and I got a little freedom, and I got a little wonder. I would like to say that this program eked into my job and eked into my home, but that's not the case. For an hour to an hour and a half, or maybe 3 or 4 hours at the hot shop, I was a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was not at home. I was still the same self-centered, arrogant, selfish son of a gun I was when I married that woman. And if you don't take it home, according to the book, you don't take it home, it ain't really doing it. You know, you ain't doing the deal unless you're doing the deal everywhere. And, you know, what happened was, the consequences of me not doing that is I started to, my sobriety, the quality of my happiness and my willingness started to deteriorate, and I got to a point where I was pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized in sobriety at 4 or 5 years. I hated you. I hated me. I hated them. I hated the job. I hated everything. I was either going to kill myself or get a sponsor. Equally tragic decisions as far as I'm concerned. I decided I'd get a sponsor. I could kill myself later. And my higher power would have sent the human sent me to Omaha, Nebraska. Now, that does not sound like AA Mecca. You know? I mean, really. But I found a man there who pissed me off. I went into the bottom of this church, and I found people that were happy. You know what I saw? Smiles from ear to ear. Hi, how you doing? Hey, how you doing? Hey, how you doing? Hey, want a cup of coffee? Yeah, happy. Hey, this so-and-so. Hey, introduce this so-and-so. I mean, they were just buzzing around. 400, 500 people all dressed up. They were just ridiculous. You know, and I'm not happy. I'm not happy. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, damn it. You know? Happy to be here, proud to serve. You know, I mean, just not happy. And they're just bouncing around having a wonderful time, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of spirit. You know, and the fact of the matter is, I was not feeling comfortable there. This man walked up to me, circled a few meetings at a meeting schedule, and handed it to me along with his phone number, and he pissed me off. Just immediately. He saw right through me. You know how it is when somebody looks at you and they see right through you? You know, like somebody gave them their inventory before they met you, you know? And it bothered me. And I'm going to tell you, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you got a man or a woman, if you're the same sex, and they're inside your head for 2 or 3 days, get them as a sponsor. What the hell? At least while they're in your head, they can do some cleaning, you know? Because I tell you, I mean, I don't go up in here, I don't go up in my mind without adult supervision, okay? Because it's a dangerous place, and I should not be in there by myself. You know, I really shouldn't. And this man became the sponsor that I needed, became the sponsor that gave structure to my life. Not because he made me do things necessarily, he showed me what doing certain things would yield as far as consequences. See, I saw how he treated his wife. And when I treated my wife the same way, I got basically the same results. I saw how he treated others. And when I treated others that way, I got basically the same results. You know, you do what we do, you get what we get. And that's an axiom. I mean, there really isn't much challenge to that. You don't have to. But it would probably be better for you if you did. That's the whole message we got in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you don't have to, you have to have a desire to stop drinking. Try some of this other stuff and you might like it. You really might like it. And I learned a lot from those people because they taught me so much about the principles and how to put those principles in my daily living. I grew up and I had a lot of fun. I got a chance to just do all kinds of wild stuff in sponsorship, around sponsorship, in fellowship, and in service work. You know, and I thought I was on a roll here. 9 years sober, I was on my way. I was ready to go. I mean, here we are at the threshold, rocketed into the fourth dimension. You know what I'm talking about? Just happy, having a wonderful time. I climbed the stairs one evening and asked this woman, you know, hon, do you still want to be married to me? Never ask a question you don't already know the answer to. Especially if you're married to the person. She said no, and I was crushed. Destroyed. But she was taking my young daughter with her. She was going to leave me. And I thought, oh, it's over. I was suffering. I was in bad shape, I thought. And the fact of the matter is, my sponsor being the type of person that he is, he knew immediately that maybe I needed to be encouraged to come on back into the meeting and get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was doing pain, like you know, like Polly was talking about. You know, you're doing the pain, and the pain will keep us away from one another. And what he walked up to me and said was, you know, it's really nice that we have the only man ever to get a divorce in Alcoholics Anonymous. These are not kind people I'm talking about. My sponsor is a cruel man sometimes, you know. And the reason why he has to be is because I am extremely self-centered and ego-driven. And sometimes the only thing that gets through to me is when you hurt my feelings, you make me see the truth. The truth doesn't really care whether I like it or not. The truth is the truth. And sometimes I am really not comfortable with it, but that's what it is. And if I don't accept it, I die, y'all have another meeting. You know, that's it. So I know where I got to be with that. And he helped me. And that fellowship helped me by involving me in things against my will, you know, into stuff that got me out of that and got me back in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I developed another, I got an opportunity to do another relationship. And I maintained a relationship with my daughter, who's here with me this weekend. You know, I didn't just send a check. I mean, I actually called. And we developed a relationship, and it's because of you that we have this relationship, because you taught me how to be consistent. You taught me how to make the call even though I know how, I didn't have anything to say. You taught me that, you know, just because she wasn't in your line of sight, that didn't absolve you of any responsibility to her. You know, and that's what I tried to act on. And I've been up and down with it, but I've been trying. And we have a good relationship today, and it's a direct result of the people and the influences of you, because I watched you treat your children a certain way, you know, and it got better. I got a chance to do television, got famous, got a little fame in Rhode Island. I was a weatherman in the military, and they sent, and I got an opportunity to do a little TV weather. Hey, how you doing? How you partly cloudy? How you doing? Wonderful, wonderful. I got a little famous and got a relationship, and I'm having a good time in Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsoring guys and being sponsored and service work and all this, and thing, the Air Force says, no, we need you to go west. West where? We need you to go to California. I don't go to California. Well, you understand. when the Department of Defense says you somewhere, they don't really care whether you want to go or not. And, so I went west. And I realized that the reason why I was going west was because there must be. I'm thinking from my higher power. My higher power isn't talking to me. I'm thinking from my higher power at this point. I must have some purpose in California. You know, there must be drunks dying by the thousands out there. I got a message of salvation for them. That's what it is. So I was ready to go. I said a tearful goodbye to Fox Hall Group, and I went on my way, going to come out of Reno and come into Sacramento and save everybody. So I got in my Nissan 4-banger Stanza and left Omaha and got as far as Cheyenne, Wyoming when the transmission fell out of that sucker. I found three things, the La Quinta Inn, Amco Station, and right down there on the end of Main Street, right next to the Pizza Hut, there's a little building. And in that little building, there's a picture of these two old white guys, 12 and 12, guy named Doc, guy named Jim, there's always a guy named Jim, always a guy named Jim, always a guy named Jim. Anywhere you go, go to meetings in Taipei, there's a guy named Jim, you know. Fact of the matter is, I met you, and I spent a couple of days there, and I went to Sacramento during its worst rainy season. I had three phone numbers, and you think at 9.5, 10 years sober that I would call those three phone numbers and get in the middle? Took me a little longer because I got scared. Scared will take you at any time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Scared will take you if you got 20 minutes or 20 years. Scared is scared, and it don't ever change. Not for us, because we are in the habit of being scared more than we are in the habit of being concerned, caring, loving, kind, consistent, honest, any of those things. We really know how to do scared. And the fact of the matter is, I got scared, and I did exactly what a scared person like me does. I sucked myself back inside, and I didn't talk to y'all, I didn't deal with y'all, until one of God's kids had to pull me out of me, called me up and told me he was going to commit suicide. And I knew he wasn't serious, you know, and I just talked to him, and I took him to a meeting, and gradually I got in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got some sponsorship experiences that I will cherish to the day I die. I got a chance to meet the President of the United States, the present one, a couple times. But each time I met him and shook his hand, soft hands, great haircut, nice suit. Each time I shook that man's hand, when I got home, I got an opportunity to sponsor another man. And that's what I'm really jazzed about, is I got an opportunity to watch the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The thing about this whole deal to me is, it's watching somebody else. You know, it's just watching somebody go, bing, you know, and finally something blooms inside of them, that their eyes light up. There was a young man that came in here this weekend, had that deer in the headlight look, you know, because y'all are a formidable force, you know. And he was welcomed in, and he wanted to be a part of this thing because it was attractive. That's a wonderful thing to see. A lot of people out there don't get a chance to see that all the time. You know, and I get a chance to see that all the time. The thing, I know that I'm in the right place, because if you're in AA, if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, you got one of them little cards that nobody around here wants to sign, you know, it's fine. If you're wondering whether or not you're drunk, that's fine. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you a little clue right now. If you're ever sitting in a meeting somewhere and somebody like me is talking on and on and on and on and on and on and on, about their alcoholism or their recovery, and you do this. You one of us. Because only one of us does this when one of us is talking. Al and I do this. I heard it here this weekend. I've heard it before. An old timer said, you know, as Bill sees it, but Lois remembers. You know what I'm saying? I am grateful that she was the only one that had a paycheck, you know. They were out doing all this good work. She was paying taxes. So, you know, I am grateful to the program of Al-Anon for my present wife, for the ability to learn that there are relationships and the responsibility of knowing that 7 other people need to be affected by my recovery. But the fact of the matter is, learning and loving and being in this fellowship has taught me so many things. The things that I carry to my job today are a direct result of some of the experiences I've had with you. Sitting in a hot shop somewhere trying to take somebody into their 90th day or their 3rd birthday or trying to get them through school or watching them buy their first house and they're 45 years old, you know? That's the deal that is amazing about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the message that we have to share to people walking in the door. There is life here. This isn't a place where the retired drunks stay. This is a place that is vibrant and real. And that's what the realm of the spirit is all about. It is alive. It is vibrant. It is powerful. And it is wonderful. And we should rejoice whether you have 10 minutes or 10 years. That's the fact, because there are so many of us that had to die for us to be here tonight or today or anywhere. I am so grateful that I've been given the opportunity to be shared with, not to share with you, but to be shared with. There are a lot of people that inconvenienced themselves to make sure that I got to stand before you this morning. There were a lot of people that put through some sacrifices, both in this program and out. Both of my parents are no longer here. You know, I'm, for all intents and purposes, an orphan. I'm also a grandparent. I'm also a parent. I'm also a husband. I'm also an employer, an employee. I'm all of those things. And all of those roles aren't too tough today when I put the principles ahead of this personality. My biggest problem is I listen to me more than I listen to you. If I listen to you more than I listen to me, I'd be okay. I know it's getting late, and I know we're about to get out of here, and we're about to go to our parties, and I'm going to stay in town for another day and have some time, some fun with my daughter, and then I'm going to go back to Omaha and become a member again. Quit being special, you know. But I want you to remember that one of the things that my sponsor told me when I come from one of these things that I'm supposed to share something, you know, take the family out or do something nice for the family, I'm supposed to carry this message, you know. I'm supposed to do 7 other folks, and I would ask you to do the same thing, because as we go out into the world, Alcoholics Anonymous lately has been coming under a lot of, well, scrutiny, and a lot of judgments have been made about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The old-timers thought that this was a haven for the recovery of people who were dying one day at a time, that they could recover one day at a time, and it was a spiritual place and a special place and a place where you could bring your mom to, and she could be impressed. And I heard a lot of people talking about family this weekend. I've brought my daughter here to meet you, and you have been warm, and you have been loving. You have been on your best behavior. And I know for a fact that if you can do it from Friday to Sunday, you can do it every day. You know, because the structure's right up in front of you. And the structure's in the experience and the strength of the old-timers that are going before us. The fun and the joy is in our willingness to be enthusiastic and consistent and committed. The love is there from our higher power. Everything is right where it needs to be, and all is right with the world. All we got to do is share it with them. We don't have to fix everybody. All we have to do is make a couple of people smile when they're in our presence. That's all. And that's easy. Anybody can do that, just like anybody can stay straight one day at a time. I'll close with a story that I always close with, because I think it really defines what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. A guy was trying to do some work, paint his house. He had a 2-year-old helping him. You know how 2-year-olds, they don't help. 2-year-olds never help. She never helped. She was 2. She ain't help. No help at all. But he decided he needed to keep her occupied, so he found a picture of the globe. All the countries, all the continents, the oceans, and everything. Tore it up into pieces and said, "Honey, go in the next room and put this puzzle together." He figured he'd have at least an hour, and he could get his stuff done. She comes scampering out about 5 minutes. finished, he was impressed. I mean, he was like, wow, you know, how did you know? I don't know where some of those places go. You know, how did you figure it out so quickly? Well, on the other side, there was a picture of a man. He said, I put the man together, the world came together. That's exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. They said, we know you're scared, Sterling. We know you got problems. We know you got situations, you know. We know all of that. But let's get you a God of your own understanding. Let's give you a structure that you can apply out there in the world, on the highway, in the department store, at work, at home. Let's give you a fellowship where you can come and talk about the challenges of doing that one day at a time. Let's give you a world, let's give you that. And then, with those tools, maybe you can take on the world. And so far, it's been a great journey. It's been a lot of fun. It's been up and down, but it's been okay. And it's directly as a result of me taking from you what you gave to me freely. And I would suggest to you, before you leave here, make an attempt to give somebody something and not expect anything in return, and then sit back and watch the results. I'm grateful to be here in Sober. Thank you.